as promised, today I want to talk a bit more about black hole thermodynamics, but to kind of, you know, go beyond the simple thermodynamics that was derived and understood in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And of course, I want to emphasize that your wonderful tutor, David Kubiznik, is one of the pioneers of this in its modern sense. So appreciate him. And I'm wondering if he's going to concoct a new tutorial tomorrow to solve his latest research problem. Okay, so this, or where this story starts, it does actually start in the 80s when people were, you know, exploring black hole thermodynamics. But what we showed, I think, when we talked about the Schwarzschild solution, was we derived something like a first law. dm was TdS. And so our entropy was the area of the black hole, and we came up with an expression for the temperature, which was most easily calculated by going to the Euclidean picture. But if we are kind of doing an analogy with thermodynamics, the analogy that people thought of was that this was T, du was TdS. So that was kind of the analogy that was being used to kind of argue that entropy was something to do with area. So of course, if we think about thermo of gases, then this is our actual first law of thermodynamics. So we have a PdV term. And so people began to think in the 80s, well, what about that PdV term? So if we ask, well, what could pressure be from a space-time perspective? So from just a pure geometry perspective, or Einstein, we think of our energy momentum tensor, so in some sort of suitable orthonormal basis, we think of our energy momentum tensor of the perfect fluid as being diagonal and having that form. Sorry, plus. Because I've got the indices downstairs. So when we do cosmology and we're thinking about solving for our universe, the expansion of the universe, and you'll get the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, the Friedman equation, this is the energy momentum tensor you use. So this is a perfect fluid. So if I want to identify a pressure, it sort of looks like a component, the spatial part, if you like, of the energy momentum tensor. And of course, we have a pure geometry or pure Einstein candidate for that in lambda. So we could imagine, maybe, that a pressure term might come from a lambda. So that was the sort of thought that was initially explored. But we know how to explore this because we solved way back when we looked at the spherically symmetric solutions, we solved for a black hole with lambda. So if you remember, if we write our ds squared is f dt squared minus dr squared on f minus r squared d omega 2 squared, then we found that f was 1 minus 2gm on r minus lambda over 3 r squared. So that was our solution for f. So I can now think, well, you know, how would I use that potential to find a law of thermodynamics? So there's various steps I need to take. I need to just check what T is, And then I need to consider the impact of throwing a particle into the black hole to try and get a differential first law. So let's deal with these one at a time. So if you remember, we said that finding the temperature was about looking at the Euclidean metric. So here I look at f d tau squared plus dr squared on f. Now, this f is going to have, as long as m isn't too big, it's going to have at least one zero, round about somewhere near 2gm. And if lambda is positive, it may have another zero. If lambda is negative, then it just has the one zero. But either way, as long as m isn't too big, there will always be one zero. So I'm going to expand near the event horizon. Trying to think of definition now. So at the moment, I'm trying to be impartial as to the sign of lambda. So f has a zero. This is our black hole horizon. And so I'm going to write f is r minus r plus times f prime at r plus, plus corrections. So I'm going to look at the metric near r plus. This is what we did with Schwarzschild. So as with Schwarzschild, I'm going to take the square root of r minus r plus as a new coordinate. So I called it rho squared. And when we did it for Schwarzschild, we put in an arbitrary multiplicative factor. But based on what we found, I'm just going to kind of jump straight to the chase here. And then that implies that rho d rho is 2 dr over f plus primed, which implies that d rho squared, which is 4 dr squared divided by rho squared f plus primed. So rho squared is 4, sorry, f plus primed squared. Rho squared is 4, so that cancels that 4, divided by f plus prime, which cancels one of those f plus primes, times r minus r plus. So that means that the radial part of the metric indeed becomes d rho squared. So now I turn to the time component. And I Taylor expand f near r plus, and then I replace the r minus r plus by the rho squared. And so I see that now my time coordinate that has periodicity 2 pi is f plus primed tau over 2. Sorry, it's 4 pi over f plus primed. So insisting that the event horizon is smooth, I now have a temperature for my space-time, which is simply related to the derivative of f at the horizon. So that's taken care of temperature. And the other thing, and of course, I just want to note, is that entropy is simply related to r plus squared. So now I'm going to try and get a differential first law. So I'm imagining, well, actually, not a small variation, let me say. So this might be throwing something into it, or it might be some other transition, perhaps changing lambda. So let's see what happens. So at the moment, I'm just going to take f. I'm going to say that 0 is delta f at whatever the new values of the parameters are. So the first thing that changes is r plus. So I have f plus prime delta r plus. That's my first change in f, a change in f that comes from shifting the horizon. Then I've got a delta m. And let me just, for the sake of completeness, although I'm not necessarily going to say that this is the right thing to do, but just let me do this for the moment. Suppose lambda changes, this is what you would get. So you're taking the system and just making a change. We'll come back and argue whether or not it's a sensible change. So now, my f plus primed, I can replace by t over 4 pi, sorry, 4 pi t. Then I look at delta r plus. So delta r plus is just g delta s over 2 pi r plus. So now I can write my delta m as t delta s, or some combination of that. So I cancel off these two pi's, and then I see that delta m, so I've got here 2g on r plus, so that just gives me t delta s as I would want. But then here I've got minus, so I've got an r plus cubed, and then I've got to divide by 2g. So that's what I end up with. So this is where I've added a lambda. And I've even allowed my lambda to vary. But notice, this is not a PDV term. So, you know, you can argue it's naive, but nonetheless, how do we find laws of thermodynamics? We consider how the black hole alters when we do something to it, either throwing something in, charging it up, maybe spinning it up. And in this case, I've said that maybe I'm changing lambda. Now, I could say, well, delta lambda shouldn't be there. But then in that case, I would just still have delta m is t delta s. And I still would not have a PDV term. So that meant that it was, whilst there was this notion that maybe lambda was like or giving you something like a pressure term, it wasn't entirely sort of working, if you like. So our lambda, remember our lambda would be 8 pi g or minus 8 pi g p. So, if I think of that, just following through that thought for a moment, interestingly, if I identify my lambda with a pressure term, that last term becomes 4 pi r plus cubed on 3. And this looks awfully like a volume of a sphere. So while we can't get a PdV term, it does look rather like we've got a VdP term. So in the sort of second phase of looking at black hole thermodynamics, Castor and Trashin kind of re-examined this and said, but actually maybe we should be thinking of a delta lambda. And so we should be thinking of our first law as dm is TdS plus VdP, and therefore m is really the enthalpy of the black hole. And so with a different perspective on how to interpret our first law, we can now include a delta lambda into black hole thermodynamics. So does this make sense? So sometimes, if you talk about this topic, the first thing that happens is someone will jump in and say, lambda's a constant. It's a cosmological constant. So what on earth do you mean varying lambda? So my first reply to this is with a cosmology hat on. Is that when you do inflation in the early universe, you have a varying lambda. So in that case, you have a scalar field which slowly rolls so that in the energy momentum tensor, these terms are subdominant so that your lambda is really just the vacuum energy of a scalar field, and the vacuum energy can change gradually if the scalar field is rolling very, very slowly. So if you had an extremely flat potential, for example, that would generate a slowly changing effective cosmological constant. And then the other way you think of a varying lambda is kind of by dualizing this notion where you've got a scalar field that's slowly rolling, and you would then dualize to say that you had a sort of three-form potential that has a four-form field strength, and the four-form is effectively, again, some number or the cosmological constant. So that was actually the way I think that the people who were first investigating lambda thought that lambda might change. So lambda can certainly change as you cross through one of these brains. So that's another way of thinking about a varying lambda. So either way, however you do it, the fact remains that this is now an intriguing way of extending thermodynamics. But once you add in a lambda, all sorts of other interesting things occur. So I want to talk about some of these and to do this, I'm going to start by being specific, and I'm going to look at black holes in anti-de Sitter space. So in anti-de Sitter space, lambda is negative, which means we have a positive pressure. So that's going to be sort of in a situation where the thermodynamic relations make more sense because P is going to be positive. So let's have a look at what we get. We've got our first law, but let's look at some of the, you know, things that we've derived in detail. So black holes and anti-de Sitter space were looked at. David, when was that paper by Hawking and Page? Is it the 70s or 80s? Oh, it's early 80s, right. So they were looked at by Stephen Hawking and Don Page, who were looking at black holes and anti-de Sitter space. At the time, I'm not entirely sure why, because, of course, anti-de Sitter space is only fashionable now in the context of string theory, which is a sort of relic of the late 90s. So my guess is that Stephen somehow noticed or thought about what was going on with the temperature. So he and Don started investigating those black holes because they realized that something very interesting was going on. So let's see what that is. So we've derived our expression for the temperature, T, as a derivative of the potential. So let me take my potential up there and see what that gives me. So that's 2gm over r plus squared minus, well, if it's an anti-de Sitter space, I'm going to say that lambda is minus 3 over L squared. So I have a length scale. So that's my F primed. So now, if I look at what this looks like, let me eliminate M so that I can see how this varies as I increase the size of my black hole. So I can eliminate the mass by looking at the constraint for M in terms of R plus. So this is 1 over R plus into 2gm on R plus, which is 1 plus R plus squared on L squared. And so I get this expression for the temperature. So now, what I notice is that if R plus is much less than L, if R plus goes to 0, T blows up. So that's very much like what happens with Schwarzschild. But now, because of this term, for very large R plus, T also blows up. So in other words, I get a curve that looks something like this. So that's very different from Schwarzschild. So if I put my Schwarzschild curve on this, it'll be something like that. So what? So just to remind ourselves, R plus is roughly 2gm if L is much bigger than gm, and R plus is roughly 2gm L squared to the 1/3 if L is much less than gm. In any case, R plus is an increasing function of mass. So this says as we add mass to the black hole, first its temperature drops, that's what we're used to from Schwarzschild, but then it starts to rise again. So what that means is that we can't have a black hole with a temperature lower than some critical temperature. So there just isn't a black hole solution with very low temperature. So let's see where this happens. So dT by dr plus. So my stationary point occurs at r plus is L over root 3. Let me call it T min. So that's my T min. So larger black holes that are roughly are larger than the ADS scale, or L over root 3, have a positive specific heat. And so they look like they are thermodynamically stable. But of course, what we really have to do to see whether they're truly stable is to make sure that they're the lowest energy configuration for a particular temperature. So in order to do this, we compare the Gibbs free energy for a black hole and pure radiation. So the reason we're doing this is because if we think about what does it mean for something to be at a particular, you know, temperature, if we've got very low temperatures, we can't have a black hole. But we should, that does, you know, surely we should be able to imagine some low temperature sort of anti-de Sitter configuration, and we can do that by adding a radiation gas. So a radiation gas has zero free energy in this sense. So we can compare the overall free energy of the black hole to the free energy of a radiation gas. So here, at this point, because I've got two G's meaning different things, at this point, I'm going to set my Newton constant to one, so that it doesn't keep sort of floating around in the expressions. You can sort of see that it's fine. It's not an issue. So I'm going to say, so it just avoids confusion. So M minus TS for the black hole. So this is my M from rearranging that F is zero. Then I've got to minus TS. So that's my minus TS, and what I get is this expression. So I see that small horizon sizes have a positive free energy, but large horizon sizes have a negative free energy. And so for R plus greater than L, G is negative, so here I can make a new point on my graph here, and this is what is called the Hawking Page transition, which is where the black hole is preferred. So usually what you see is you see a plot of G, the free energy, against T, which looks something like that. So this is our Hawking Page transition. So the temperature, when we input the value of R plus, is just 1 over pi L. So in their paper, Hawking and Page conjectured that if you looked at anti-de Sitter space, say with a radiation bath in it, at very low temperatures, the only possible solution is the radiation bath. Then you hit this sort of critical temperature at which you can have a black hole. So this is kind of here. But that black hole still has higher free energy than the radiation bath. So even though it's a possible solution, it's not the preferred solution. As you increase the temperature, though, you hit this Hawking-Page temperature, at which this, the radiation free energy, is now higher than the free energy of a large black hole at the same temperature. And so they had this notion that somehow this radiation bath would spontaneously collapse into a large black hole. And correspondingly, if you had a black hole in this region, it would somehow spontaneously tunnel into just a pure radiation gas. So that's the sort of notion of what might happen. And it's the first sort of example that you see of critical phenomena occurring in the case of black hole thermodynamics. So even though at the time people thought anti-de Sitter space was just a mathematical oddity or curiosity, nonetheless, you know, the thermodynamics of black holes in anti-de Sitter space seemed to be very interesting. So let's investigate further. So what I want to do now is, I think the simplest, algebraically simplest thing to do is to add charge. So what that does is it adds a 1 over r squared term in GTT, in our function f of r. So here, E is actually the charge of the black hole, Q, which is the integral of the dual of f over the horizon, or just over any two sphere, really. And of course, the vector potential is E over R dt. Plus or minus, I always get the signs confused. So now we've got two things that we're going to compare to L. We've got the mass of the black hole. So the mass could be bigger, or this mass here. Think of this as GM. This is telling you sort of where the horizon is. You know, that's what's determining whether the horizon moves in or out, in part. So M could be bigger than or less than L, and we know from our experience with the uncharged black hole that that corresponds to some interesting phenomena with the temperature. But now, if we look at the charge, we can also compare the charge to L or to the mass. Now, if there's no cosmological constant, this F equals zero is a quadratic, so we know what the roots are, and we find that in general there are two roots, unless E becomes too big, and too big means whether E becomes equal to this M. So without a cosmological constant, we know that there is a critical extremal limit of the black hole where we've put as much charge on as we possibly can. So, if we look now at adding in the cosmological constant, F equals zero is a quartic, and it's, you know, it's got r to the fourth, r squared, r and constant terms, so it's not like we've got a nice, easy solution for F. But qualitatively, for a given M, we have a horizon so we can see this is the only negative term in F. So as we increase E, we're adding to F, and so that means that it's harder for, you know, the F to have a zero. So R plus has to get smaller so that this negative term gets bigger. So for a given M, as we increase E, R plus has to drop. And so we can see that there's a critical value of E for which the horizon is about to disappear. So when the horizon is about to disappear, that's when F and F primed are zero. So if F primed is zero, then T is zero. So this is all true even without the cosmological constant. So we have an extremal limit for our black hole, and it has zero temperature. So now this is kind of an interesting distinction, because if I look over here, if I have a given charge and then add mass to my black hole to make it bigger, as it gets really, really big, the effect of the charge is going to be insignificant. So I still expect my curve up here for the temperature dependence in terms of R plus, but now I'm seeing that there's going to be some finite R plus at which T is zero. So it's changed this plot here, this sort of Hawking page plot. So if I again just sketch without knowing the detail, I expect that I've still got this curve up here. I also expect that I've got something here. So this is my extremal limit. So now what happens in between? So here I can kind of use my intuition from the Reissner-Nordström black hole. If I don't have the cosmological constant term, my temperature first increases, because it ought to go somewhere from zero. But then as my black hole gets big in flat space time, the temperature starts to decrease again, because that's what happens in flat space time. We don't have this part of the curve. So one possibility, let's get two different colors. One possibility is that my curve does this between those two points. And that will happen if the size of the black hole is sufficiently small that it kind of achieves this Riesz-Nordström limit. So if M and E are much less than L, then I can forget about this term till I get to very big black holes and I get this oscillatory behavior. But if M and E are big, that means this term becomes important quite early on. And so I just simply get a monotonic function. So here we're talking about M and E either comparable or bigger than L. And the purple is M or E much less than L. So just by giving a sort of very qualitative, hand-wavy type argument, I can see now that depending on what the value of E is, because E tells me where I hit zero, I get two possible behaviors for my temperature. So you can see now that just adding this one extra parameter to the black hole, we already had something interesting, we already had something different. And now you see we've got something even more different again. So let's look at how our thermodynamics changes with the charge. So here I said the Q was basically E. I need to have a potential. So I think I'm going to keep, otherwise I'm going to get my signs all over. As long as you're consistent, it doesn't matter. So I'm going to define the potential, which is simply the electrostatic potential, its value on the horizon, or it's really the difference between the horizon and infinity. And then I do the same game with delta F. So I do exactly what I did on the first, second board for the uncharged black hole. And I know this is going to turn into my TdS term. And I get the same VdP term as before. So all I've done really is souped up my first law to include the effect of charge. So it's the same sort of standard thermodynamic type of first law. So now let's look at what happens to our Hawking-Page story. So what happens to the free energy? So this is my mass. So what I want to do is I want to think about, at the moment, I'm thinking about that plot that I did of G against T. And I want to just think about what happens when I have these different phases where I have turning points in the temperature. So this thing here is actually T dS by dR plus. So this tells me that the way in which my Gibbs free energy changes as I increase R plus is directly proportional to the way the temperature changes. And so if my temperature has a turning point, my Gibbs free energy has a turning point, and vice versa. If the temperature doesn't, the free energy doesn't. So again, without actually computing anything explicitly, I can qualitatively draw what happens for these two different cases. So if I draw my GT phase plane, let's take the brown line where there is no turning point. So what that's saying is we've got our extremal limit, which occurs at finite R plus. So T is zero at some finite value here. So again, I'm just drawing things qualitatively so that we can understand what happens. And T keeps increasing as I increase R plus, but then I look at what happens to G, and I can sort of see that G is also increasing as R plus increases. So in fact, I kind of should make this sort of go like that. I was expecting to do something different, but this is what I'm getting here. Sorry. Me and minus signs. I knew that was wrong. So it's something like that. It's going down. Now let's look at what happens for the purple case, which is where our R plus is smaller, our charge is smaller, and so we have turning points. So we still start at some extremal limit, like so, but now both G and T have a turning point. So G was decreasing, so now it's going to increase. T was increasing, so now it's going to decrease. So I go there. I then hit my second turning point, and I have to come back again. And I know I have to end up with Hawking Page, so I end up sketching that. So that means, therefore, that as I go from brown to purple, I start to get a little swallowtail that develops if I were to kind of move out of the board and change the charge, because as I drop the charge, my critical R plus drops. So panning through these sketches, as I'm moving in this direction, that's sort of what happens. So I'm not claiming any significance of precisely where I put those lines because I've done absolutely nothing quantitative in this argument. All I've done is I've argued based on what we know about the uncharged black hole and about what happens at large mass or large R plus in anti-de Sitter, and also what we know if there was no cosmological constant. And we know that that has something to do with how big M and or E are in relation to L. So I don't have the keyboards, let me just use the corner of this. So this is a swallowtail. So let's look at what this critical value of E is. So my, where is it? Here, no. Didn't write it down. Okay. So let's see if we can get some quantitative, at least something that's not just a hand wavy, let me sketch something for you type of argument. So if I calculate the temperature of the charged black hole, that's simply the derivative of F at the horizon divided by 4 pi. I then take the derivative of F and substitute in for 2m using the fact that F is zero on the horizon, and I get this expression. So you can compare it to this one here, and you see that there's just some E squared on R squared pieces that have been added. So now I take dt by dr plus, because whether or not we have a turning point depends on whether or not there's a root to this equation. And now I'm rather relieved because actually whether t has a zero depends on whether this bracket has a zero, and this is now a quadratic for r plus squared. So, phew, I can solve a quadratic easily. So this is zero at r plus squared is l squared over 6. So that now justifies the fact that there are two turning points in a quantitative manner, rather than just my qualitative argument about the behavior of T near the extremal limit and at very large horizon radius. So we see explicitly there are two turning points there, because there's two roots for dt by dr plus equals zero. So, so I justified my rather sketchy analysis there that was simply argued by drawing. So here we actually now see what this bound is on the charge of the black hole for this sort of swallowtail to exist. Wondering whether to say anything about rotation or not. I think what I'll do is I'll just give you some of the ideas about rotation, but not necessarily go into some of the calculational details, which turn out to be a bit more hefty, but there's still some interesting things going on. So the first, first challenge is to get ourselves a nice metric for the rotating black hole in ADS. Actually, I should say, because I always like to advertise when people that you might know have done stuff, this swallowtail. Rob Myers was one of the co-authors of the paper that first noticed these critical phenomena in charged ADS black holes. So your new and fearless leader was with that. So here, my F is going to be essentially what the other F was, but now generalized. So there's a few things that I want to just draw to your attention as being distinct from the standard black holes, so that if you want to read up on this or try things out yourself, I've kind of tried to describe some of the tripping points or the things that trip people up in the literature, because this was a story that took a few tries to get right and to understand precisely what was going on. So finding the solution for rotating Kerr in ADS is simply a question of solving Einstein equations, and you have the Kerr solution in flat space as a guide. So that's kind of how this comes out. So the sigma is what it was for Kerr. F, well, it's sort of partly what you'd expect. You add an A squared on R squared, which was in Kerr. This term, rather than R squared on L squared, it's R squared plus A squared on L squared. But that's okay, because actually, when you think about the area of the black hole, you get an R squared plus A squared. So that's not outrageous that that should be there. The thing that's really new is this G term. And that really just comes about because of looking at the Einstein equations. It's a set of equations and two variables, r and theta. And more or less, this a squared on l squared cos squared theta is sort of similar to this a squared on l squared sitting there. Think of it that way. So why did I add this term here? So the reason I added that is actually because of that G function. If I look at theta tends to zero, so I look at what happens on the axis, and I ask what is happening locally to the metric, it should really look like the origin of polar coordinates, where theta is more like my radius now, and phi is the azimuthal angle. So here, sigma, if theta is zero, sigma is r squared plus a squared. G is 1 minus a squared on l squared. And then if I look at what happens to g theta theta and g phi phi, I've got my, if I look at the theta phi part of the metric, I have sigma over g, so that's r squared plus a squared divided by 1 minus a squared on l squared times d theta squared. Now if I look at my d phi squared, this is going to zero like theta to the fourth, so I forget about that, and I've just got this piece here. So that gives me r squared plus a squared all squared, so here's one of them, but then I divide by sigma, so that takes care of the other one. But now I have two versions of g, because I've got a g here, and then I've pulled out this factor here. So that is my metric as theta goes to zero. So, sorry, it should be the psi squared. So this tells me that I need to have psi equal to 1 minus a squared on L squared if I want the periodicity of my phi to be 2 pi. Now, as I add or subtract angular momentum from a black hole, once I've got my coordinates, I can't be changing the periodicity of my angular coordinate. So once I've set it, I have to keep it fixed. So the easiest thing to do is to set phi as 2 pi and add this parameter psi. So what that then means is that various other quantities get rescaled. So for example, my s is now r plus squared plus a squared divided by this psi, because I now have in root g a 1 over psi coming from the phi integral. The other thing that's curious is that if I look at the angular momentum at some value of r, then that's equal to gt phi over g phi phi. And if I look at that as r goes to infinity, well, gt phi, if I look at this cross term here, f goes like r squared, sigma goes like r squared, so this gt phi is going like r squared, whereas here, this cross term is r squared, but I'm dividing by r squared, so I just get the f here. So my gt phi is a r squared sine squared theta divided by l squared psi. And then my g phi phi is this term plus this term. Which is g over psi squared sine squared theta times 1 minus r squared a squared over l squared psi squared sine to the fourth theta. So what I see, various bits cancel. This g is 1 minus a squared on l squared cos squared, and here's minus an a squared on l squared sine squared. Sorry, that should have an r squared in it. And so what I end up with is minus a on l squared. So what this means is that infinity is not unlike flat space. When you look at the frame dragging of Kerr, the frame dragging effect falls off as you go to asymptotic infinity. In anti-de Sitter space, that doesn't happen. So in these sort of very natural coordinates, frame dragging happens at infinity. And so this means that you have to do all sorts of corrections to your thermodynamic parameters and potentials. So I'll just write down what you get and finish. So the mass is now rescaled actually twice by psi. It's rescaled once because you've kind of got less than 2 pi, if you like. Although your angular range is 2 pi, you've got this 1 over psi. But then because the frame is being dragged at infinity, you kind of have to subtract that effect, and that gives you an additional factor of this capital Xi. And then your omega is actually the horizon omega minus this rotation at infinity. Wrote down these things. It's a nightmare to remember. The charge kind of does more or less what you'd expect. There's nothing particularly special going on with charge. But what's really interesting is that the thermodynamic volume, so you'd expect that to get a 1 over Xi. So this is like the geometric volume. But now you get an extra piece dependent on angular momentum. So this is kind of interesting because it's saying that this thermodynamic volume of the black hole is being corrected by the a term dependent on the rotation of the black hole. And why this is really useful from the perspective of analyzing the general thermodynamics is that in this original expression, S was given in terms of R plus squared, and so was V. So if you had, isentropic? Where constant entropy, there's some word for it that I'm just blanking on. So lines of constant entropy were also lines of constant volume. So if you were going to construct cycles in a PV plane, constant V also had constant entropy. Can't remember the word. But here, by adding this extra piece to V, you've now split this degeneracy, and so you truly have sort of a full, in terms of your thermodynamic parameter space, it's now completely linearly independent. So if you don't have these correction terms, then you've kind of somehow partially collapsed your parameter space. Anyway, I've shockingly overrun, so I shall stop here. I'm nearly done.